Thank you, Alison, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm going to talk about how we can best use DNA data in the selection of cattle. And there'll be some background. I'm going to talk a bit about how genomic selection, what it is and what it works, the implementation of it. I hope I'll cover along the way how it can be used and say something very briefly about the future. So, some traits are controlled by a single gene. For example, red versus black coat colour. But most of the traits that we're interested in, whether it's growth rate or marbling or reproduction, are controlled by many genes and by environmental factors. A sad thing for a geneticist is that we don't actually know what the genes controlling most of those traits are. If I met a fertility gene on the street, I wouldn't recognise it. So what we've traditionally done is that we've not tried to look at individual genes, we've tried to estimate the combined effect of all of the genes on a particular trait, using performance information and information from pedigrees, information on relatives. And we wrap all that together as an EPD. One way of drawing it is like this. We've got performance information, we've got pedigree information, and we use that to get EPDs. The genes themselves have been a black box. We haven't actually known what genes we were estimating the effects of in our EPDs. Despite this, it's been very successful. This is a graph for Australian dairy cattle, but I could have, or you could have put up a graph for American beef cattle showing the genetic improvement over the years. And there's been enormous genetic gains in nearly all of the livestock industries. Now, the genetic variation that we all work with is due to differences in DNA sequence. That's a remarkable thing when you think about it. How can a difference in the DNA sequence make some people taller than other people, or some cattle more prone to marbling than others? I don't know how it works, but that's what happens. So here's two little DNA sequences, if I can get the pointer in the right place. They're the same, except that at this particular point here, one of them has a C, and this one in another animal perhaps has a G. Pointer is hard to control. Okay, so there's a difference in DNA sequence. And it's these differences in DNA sequence that are the genetic variation that we manipulate, whether we know it or not. So the aim of having this DNA sequence information is to use the variation in DNA sequence, add that to the traditional information on phenotypes and pedigree, and get more accurate. I've got here EBVs, I lapsed into Australian talk instead of American. A breeding value is just twice a progeny difference. So where I say EBVs, just translate them to EPDs. More accurate EBVs, and to get them at a younger age, because the advantage of a DNA sequence information is that you can get it at birth and it doesn't change. So some of the variations that we see in DNA sequence, like I've illustrated here, they're just a single base difference, where this one is C, this one is A. And they're called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs for short. And they're the most commonly used polymorphisms or variations in DNA that are currently being used. So you'll hear lots of talk about SNPs. It's single because it's just a single letter that's different, nucleotide because these things are nucleotides, and polymorphism means a place where there's variation. Just call them SNPs. Now, the variation that actually causes differences in traits we're interested in is still not known. But what we do have is hundreds of thousands of these SNPs scattered all over the genome, all over the chromosomes, and we can use them as markers. They're not actually the functional cause of variation, but they're a marker for it. And the beauty of having so many of them is that we now have a SNP which is close on a chromosome to any gene which actually causes variation. Here is a chromosome. Here is a gene that affects a trait. Let's imagine it's a gene affecting marbling. There are two different variants of this gene. One increases marbling and one decreases marbling. But we don't know what that gene is. We can't assay it in the laboratory. But a little bit up the chromosome is a SNP that we can assay in the laboratory. Some chromosomes carry a C and some carry a G, and the way I've illustrated it, most of the ones that carry a C have the plus gene for marbling, and most of the ones that carry the G have the minus gene for marbling. So we can select animals that are C at this particular marker, and most of the time we'll get animals that carry this plus gene for marbling. And of course, what we aim to do is to use those markers to predict the breeding value or progeny difference for each animal for a particular trait. So essentially, we're adding a third source of information to the calculation of EPDs. We've traditionally had phenotypes and pedigree, and now we're including DNA information in the calculation of EPDs. And the importance of putting it up to you like this in this diagrammatic form is to emphasise that at a certain level nothing changes. You're still using EPDs. That's the critical thing. There's nothing different about using DNA sequence data. It's just an additional form of information that goes into that calculation of EPDs. So this is an overview of the things that have to happen for genomic selection to work. First of all, you need a discovery population. That's a population of cattle where you've actually measured the trait, you've got phenotypes, and you've also scored them for the markers. So you've got genotypes and phenotypes, and from that data you derive a prediction equation. A prediction equation is just an equation that takes DNA genotypes as input and produces estimates of progeny difference, EPDs, or breeding value as output. That prediction equation then needs to be tested in a separate population of animals. I've called it a validation population, but the term validation is a bit unfortunate. It's just that it's what we've become in the habit of using that term. But what we use the validation population for is to estimate the accuracy of the prediction equation. Then there's a group of animals here called selection candidates. So these are real live animals where we want to make a selection decision. And we've got a sample of DNA, we've sent it to the laboratory, and we've got DNA genotypes. So we combine the DNA genotypes with the prediction equation, and we get a prediction of breeding value, which I'm calling an MBV, marker breeding value. But this terminology hasn't settled down yet, and other people are calling it other things. I'll just stick with marker breeding value, or MBV. These selection candidates, though, are likely to have other information as well. It might be phenotypes on themselves or on their relatives. Their sire perhaps has an EPD. And so we can combine all the information, the traditional EPD and these marker breeding values, to give what I'm going to call a genomic EPD. Now again, we don't seem to have settled exactly on the terminology, but the important thing really is that I want to distinguish between the marker breeding value that's based solely on the markers and the genomic EPD that's got the traditional information as well as the marker information. So in the remainder of the talk, I'll talk a little bit about the genetic architecture of economic traits, about the discovery population, the validation population, the implementation, and the future. What do I mean by genetic architecture? I mean, how many genes are there for a particular trait, how big are their effects, and if they've got a plus allele and a minus allele, how common are those two? So, how many genes? The best information, strangely enough, comes from humans. Peter Visscher summarised three studies on the genetics of human height. These were big studies when you put them all together. They had about 500,000 SNPs scored on 63,000 people. They found 95 highly significant SNPs, and 54 of them could be verified in new populations of people. There were only three genes that came up in all three studies, and that says to me that if you did a fourth study, you'd find new ones again. They're not just finding the same things over again. The effect of these SNPs was tiny. They ranged from about 4 millimetres to 8 millimetres. And because they were so tiny, they explained a very small percentage of the variance each. These highly significant SNPs explained somewhere between 0.1 and 0.4% of the variation. So if the biggest genes that you've got explain 0.4% of the variation, then obviously you need hundreds or thousands of genes to explain all of the variation. So to the extent that human height is a classical quantitative trait, and we expect a lot of other traits to be the same, there are hundreds or thousands of genes for the average trait, and each of them has small effects. Just for something that's a bit closer to home, we looked at our dairy cattle data. We had 38,000 SNPs and we estimated their effect on milk protein yield. And for each SNP, the statistical analysis gave us an F value, a measure of the significance of it. And you can see that there were lots and lots of very small F values and some really, really big ones. But of course, when you test 38,000 of them, you expect to get some big ones just by chance. So we modelled the real variation in the effect of these SNPs plus the random variation from sampling error, and we were able to fit a model to the data where we had a mixture of normal distributions. We had some SNPs with a very little effect, some SNPs with a slightly bigger one, and some SNPs with a slightly bigger one. And to our surprise, what we found was that the best fit, not necessarily the right answer, but the best fit to the data, was this one where we had 76% of the SNPs had tiny little effects, 20% explained about 0.1% of the variance each, and 4% explained 0.3% of the variance each. Very similar to the answer for human height. So I think if we're getting similar answers for human height and for milk yield in dairy cows, we're probably going to get similar answers for lots of other traits. Just in case you don't think I fitted the model correctly, here's the actual number of F values for at each level and the number fitted by the model, and it's not perfect, but I think you'll agree it's a reasonably good fit to the data. So, of course, it's not true that all of these SNPs have an equally small effect on each trait. There's a distribution of effects. I've tried to illustrate here with this pink graph the distribution of effects of new mutations, because all of this variation originally comes from mutations. And every generation there's a bit of extra variation added in the form of new mutations. And I've used a exponential distribution here showing that the most common mutations have small effects, but there are some out here that have reasonably large effects. They're rare, but they do exist. However, it's likely that most of these mutations are subject to selection. They're slightly deleterious and selection acts against them. And common sense, I think, says that the bigger the effect they have on traits of interest, the bigger the selection coefficient against them is likely to be. So I've illustrated here in the blue graph what would be the final frequency of these different sized genes if the selection against them was proportional to the size of the effect that they had on the trait. And what you see then is that the little genes become very much more common, because in most of the cases the big genes get eliminated by natural selection or by artificial selection. And what we're left with at the end of the day is lots and lots of small genes of small effect. Okay, so within those genes that are affecting a trait such as growth rate or marbling or whatever, let's say that there's a positive allele and a negative allele, two variants. Are they roughly equally common, like 50-50, or is one of them very common and one of them very rare? Because obviously if one of them's very rare, it's a lot harder to find those genes. So if you think that these mutations have no effect on fitness, and that the population size, the effective population size of cattle has always been the same, you can just look up the textbook and it'll tell you the distribution that you expect for those allele frequencies. And it'll tell you that most of the time the mutant allele is very rare, but occasionally it gets common just by luck, and sometimes it even reaches 100% of the population. Unfortunately, that's not what really happened in cattle. In cattle, we've had a decrease in effective population size. There were lots of wild cattle once upon a time, but when we domesticated them, we decreased the number of breeding animals. And when we formed herd books, we decreased it again. So that we've now reached a level of inbreeding of about 50% relative to the population before domestication. And what that does is that it flattens off that graph of allele frequencies, so that now almost all of the allele frequencies are equally common for genes which have no effect on fitness, genes that don't get selected. Of course, I just argued 5 minutes ago that most of the genes that affect real traits actually do get selected. So the selection pushes us back to having a lot of genes where the allele frequency is close to naught if the mutant is getting selected against, or if the mutant is actually favourable and gets selected for, they'll be close to one. So we're going to end up with a lot of genes where there's one very common allele and one relatively rare allele. What about the discovery population? So it's just a population where we've got phenotypes, measurements of performance, and we've got DNA genotypes. And I'll look at the statistical methods to derive the prediction equations, and how many animals do we need, and how many SNPs do we need. So there's two classes of statistical method for predicting the breeding value from the SNPs. One of them is called BLUP, and it basically assumes that all of the SNPs, if there's 50,000 of them, all 50,000 of them have some effect. And the other method has got to be called Bayes B or some variant of that, and it assumes that only some of the SNPs have an effect, and consequently the ones that do have an effect have larger effects than in the BLUP model. When we first did this, we did some simulation, as geneticists are prone to do, and Bayes B gave us slightly higher accuracies than the BLUP. But in real data, we find that most of the time there's not much difference. This is for milk protein yield in dairy cattle, and the correlation between the actual EPD after progeny test and the prediction before progeny test was about 0.6 for both methods. Why is this so? Well, the difference between the two methods depends on how many genes there are affecting that trait. Now, I've already told you there are lots, but exactly how many starts to matter. And the choice between the methods depends on something called the effective number of chromosome segments. And you can think of little bits of chromosome being inherited from father to son or mother to daughter throughout the population. And the effective number of chromosome segments depends on the effective population size and the length of the genome in recombination units. So, for example, within a breed like Holstein, the effective population size is about 100 and the genome is 30 Morgans long. So that makes 3,000 effective chromosome units in Holsteins. And so you might say, well, if there's thousands of genes affecting a trait, then there's virtually as many genes as there are chromosome segments. BLUP will work best. However, if you want something that works across breed, then you have to look at a bigger effective population size. The effective population size of the population of cattle before it split into breeds. Let's say that's 1,000. You're now looking at 30,000 effective chromosome segments, and assuming there aren't 30,000 genes for each trait, we would predict that Bayes B will work better when we go to these across breed populations. But in order to do that, we'll have to have larger numbers of SNPs. The 50,000 that we're working with at the moment is not enough to be able to model very small chromosome segments. The accuracy of the prediction depends on this parameter here. T is the total number of animals in your discovery population. H squared is obviously the heritability, and NE is the effective population size, and L is the length of the chromosome in Morgans. So what this means is that if you decrease the heritability, you have to increase the total number of animals in your discovery population in order to get the same accuracy at the end of the day. So the total number of animals matter and the heritability matters. That's shown in this graph here. These are the accuracy that you expect from your genomic prediction according to the number of animals in the discovery population and according to the heritability of the trait. So if you've got 4,000 animals with a very highly heritable trait, you're up here at an accuracy of about 0.7, but if it's a lowly heritable trait, you're down here at about 0.3. Now, these are predictions of accuracy from theory. I thought I had a graph showing how well they worked, but I don't. They work pretty well. The results we've got in practice line up with these predictions pretty well. So you'll notice that these are big numbers of animals. It's no good having 200 animals in your discovery population. 200's right down here. You've got to be talking about thousands of animals. Does the same prediction equation work across different breeds? Well, before we actually had prediction equations, we just looked at the correlation between markers across breeds. Do the alleles that go together in one breed also go together in another breed? Because the prediction equation relies on this association between the marker and the real gene. And what we found was that for very closely related breeds, like Angus and Red Angus, they went together quite well, so we could expect the same prediction equation to work in both Angus and Red Angus. But for distantly related breeds, it was hopeless. For Angus and Brahman, there was essentially no correlation between what went together in one breed and what went together in another breed. So we tried this out in dairy cattle. I'm sorry to keep coming back to dairy cattle, but we've got much better data on dairy cattle than we do on beef cattle. And we derived an equation in Holsteins, and we tested it in Jerseys, and it was completely hopeless. Now, it is possible to get one that works in both Holsteins and Jerseys if you have both Holsteins and Jerseys in your discovery population. But I think it gets harder and harder as you put more breeds into that and you expect the same equation to work across lots of different breeds. In order to get it to work across all the Bos Taurus breeds, I estimate that we'll need greater than 300,000 SNPs, not the 50,000 that we're currently working with. And I think we'll always need different prediction equations for Bos Indicus and Bos Taurus. They're just too distantly related. What about the validation population? One of the problems of working in this field is that the prediction equation always works in the population where you discovered it, and it nearly always fails to work in every other population you tested in. So it's really important to show that your prediction equation will work in a new population, different to the one where you discovered it. And obviously what you want that validation population to be is similar to the populations where you're actually going to use the thing for real. It's not satisfactory to do what seems obvious, is to take your group of animals that have got phenotypes and genotypes and randomly split them and treat one half as the discovery and one half as the validation. That gives you an unrealistically good answer compared with going out and getting a completely unrelated group of animals to do the validation in. The purpose of the validation is to estimate the accuracy with which the prediction equation works. So this is where the name validation is a bit misleading, because the answer isn't yes or no. It's not that we succeeded in validating the prediction equation or we failed. The answer is a number like 0.37. It's the correlation between what the prediction equation tells you and the truth. Now, we're working towards a method for calculating this accuracy directly from the discovery population without having to have a separate validation population. But we're not there yet. I think for a few years yet, it's going to be very important to have these validation populations to estimate how well the prediction worked. Just to air dirty linen in public, a few years ago, before we had the 50K SNP chip, we had a 10K, 10,000 SNP panel put out by Paralleel. And we did an experiment on residual food intake or net food intake, and we found lots of significant SNPs. It was terrific. We then tested those SNPs in other populations. We tested them in another group of animals from the same population as the discovery. Different animals, different year of birth, but the same population. And they sort of worked. Can't get the pointer to work. Out of the 12 that was significant, they all had effects in the same direction in the validation population to what they'd had in the discovery population. We then tested them in other Angus cattle, because these had been Angus, and not many of them worked, 6 out of 9 in the right direction, better than chance, I suppose. We tested them in completely different breeds, and the results were just like random chance. So I put this up not to convince you how hopeless a scientist I am, because you probably know that already, but to point out that this, it really is very difficult to get these things to work in new populations. So why is the validation rate so poor? Well, the individual SNPs have small effects, and so they're hard to estimate accurately. If you estimate things poorly, then you can't expect to get the same answer again next time. Secondly, the linkage disequilibria, or LD, is different between breeds. The correlations between the marker and the gene that apply in one breed don't necessarily apply in other breeds. And an additional problem is that the genes that actually cause effects typically have one allele that's rare. Now, this is the argument I made to you earlier on about genetic architecture, and it has two bad consequences. Firstly, it means that none of the SNPs that are on the panel tag the causal gene very well, because the causal gene's rare and the SNPs are common. And secondly, it means that the contribution of a particular causal gene to the variance changes from one population to another. Because if something's there at a frequency of 1% in the population, your particular herd of cattle might have that at 0% and it's useless, or it might have it at 5% because you got a sire who was a carrier. So the answers, the real answers, fluctuate from one set of cattle to another. So what are the lessons from this typically bad experience? You need very large discovery populations so that you estimate the effects accurately in the first place. And you really need to do the discovery and the validation in the same breed or breeds. You need to use enough animals in the validation sample so that you've got a hope of finding these small effects. And the validation population should represent the population where you're actually going to use the information. When you put the last and the second of these two things together, it means that you've really got to do the discovery in the breeds where you want to use the prediction. Because we want this to work across breeds, we need SNP chips with more SNPs on them. But fortunately, that's on the way. We will have larger SNP chips in a year or two's time. We possibly also need better methods for handling these causal genes with low allele frequencies. Okay, on to implementation. This is the same diagram as before. Traditionally, we've got phenotypes and pedigrees calculating EPDs. Now we've got DNA genotypes, and I've just put in this extra step. We take them to marker breeding values, and then we combine them with the traditional EPVs to get these genomic EPDs. It's the same. Now, we've got two different ways of doing this being developed within the livestock industries. In the beef industries, both in America and in Australia, what's happening is that the DNA companies are developing the prediction equation, and they're calculating an MBV and supplying the MBV to the genetic evaluation centre, the place that calculates EPDs. and that's okay. The dairy industry is developing a different model where the raw DNA genotypes are supplied to the genetic evaluation system, USDA in Beltsville in the case of American dairy industry, and they develop the prediction equation and they do the combination with traditionally the EPDs to get the genomic EPDs. The dairy industry model has some advantages. It means that the prediction equation is constantly being updated by new information, because USDA, or in our case ADHIS, has available all of the raw genotypes on all of the animals, and eventually some of those animals get measured for phenotypes, and so the prediction equation can be constantly updated with new commercial information. The data that's stored is more stable. The marker breeding values depend upon the prediction equation. So every time you change the prediction equation, the MBV changes, whereas the DNA raw genotypes should be the same forever, barring mistakes made. Consequently, because you're storing information that doesn't change, it should be less prone to errors. When you're storing MBVs, you've got to remember which MBV it is you've stored. And if you have MBVs, in order to utilise them in the calculation of these genomic EPDs, you have to know the covariances amongst all the different MBVs that are in the marketplace. So I'm suggesting to you that there might be a different way of doing this. Okay, what about the future? Well, this genomic technology just keeps getting better. It's like computers. Every 18 months it doubles in capacity. We will have 300,000 or more SNP chips available to us in the not too distant future. In the not too distant future, we will actually be able to use full genome sequencing. Remember the human genome sequence? The first one cost $100 million or something. It's now down to $100,000, and it'll be less and less as time goes on. DNA profiles of some sort, I predict, will become very common, so that lots of cattle will have those. And we won't see them as a sort of an add-on that a few cattle have that we add on to the EPD. The DNA genotypes will be used directly in the calculation of EPDs for all cattle. There'll be no EPDs that don't have the genomic information available to them. This technology, I think, is very good. It's the biggest thing that's happened since the invention of EPDs, but it's potentially disruptive. It could change the structure of the breeding industry. Now, when I gave this talk in Australia, I was accused of bashing the stud sector. And let me be clear, I'm not advocating that this is what should happen. I'm warning you that this is what might happen. We could see a decrease in recording. Traditional phenotypic recording might decrease because people can get EPDs without doing the recording. That will lead somebody to realise that they could sell bulls very cheaply. They could rear bulls essentially as cheaply as steers. No recording, no pedigree, no nothing, and they could sell very good bulls into the marketplace. They could also have selection for novel traits, traits which are currently not amongst those that we can record. And it's possible that we'll see some vertical integration where a big packer or a big supermarket chain says, if you want to sell cattle or carcasses to me, use these sort of bulls. Use the ones that have the markers for tenderness or for whatever it is thereafter. And we could see a move towards the pig and poultry model. Do you know that in the poultry industry, there's only 3 poultry breeding companies in the whole world? Now, I don't think it will get to that in beef cattle, but you could see that this technology could lead to a big shift in the structure of the stud industry. So to summarise, the genetic architecture of the traits that we're interested in, economic traits. Typically, there are hundreds or thousands of genes for each trait. Most of the markers have very small effects, so you have to add lots of them together to get a meaningful prediction. However, there's probably not an infinite number of these genes affecting quantitative traits or economic traits. There's a number of them, but it's a large number, it's not infinity. Typically, these genes that affect quantitative traits or economic traits will have one rare allele, and that has implications for trying to tag them and use them in genomic selection. What about the discovery population? Well, the best method of estimating the prediction equation depends upon the number of genes there are for these traits. And I've argued that there's lots of genes, but not an infinite number of them. So the method called Bayes-B is best if the number of genes is small, and Bluff is best if the number of genes is large. And by large, I mean it approaches the effective population size times the genome length. So I predict that Bayes-B was going to be better as we go to a crossbreed prediction using large numbers of SNPs. We need large populations of cattle in order to get accurate predictions. If you want an accuracy of 0.7, you need 14,000 cattle for a trait which has a heritability of 0.3. So, you know, we've got to think of ways of having large discovery populations. And if the heritability of a trait is low, you need even more cattle. One thing that we've done to try and overcome this problem is to form an international collaboration between America and Australia and Canada so that we can put together our experiments and create a much bigger experiment. You need to use multiple breeds in your discovery if you want to use it in multiple breeds, and you need to use a lot of SNPs. I think I'm getting the wind up. The validation population needs to be similar to the population where you want to use it. Disappointing results are common. The purpose of the validation is to estimate the correlation between the prediction, the MBV, and the real genetic value. The beef and dairy industries are developing different models, and I think the dairy model has some advantages. I think it will deliver more accurate EPDs. Thank you.